This is the second of a short series of studies in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now we're unable to go back completely over what we discussed last time, but just a brief recap. You may remember that we considered that the book of Ecclesiastes was the work of Solomon, and we had one or two evidences from the book itself that this indeed was so. That Solomon wrote this book in his old age. He wrote it as he looked back upon a life, a long series of experiences that he'd had as a man who could have everything that could come to his hand. A man who had tremendous wealth, a man who had wonderful wisdom given to him from God. And yet he could look back upon this life of pleasure and see that there was no satisfaction in it. There was no profit. Nothing was over and remaining. He got simply the pleasure of the moment, and that was that. And so he asked the question in chapter 1 and verse 3 of this book, "What profit hath a man of all his labour which he taketh under the sun?" And he writes across that the word vanity. "Vanity of vanities," saith the preacher. "Vanity of vanities. All is vanity." This is how he begins this book. Of course, we mustn't imagine that he came to this conclusion at the beginning. He did what every writer does. He wrote the preface last. This is his conclusion, vanity of vanities. So he writes the preface concerning vanity. Then throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, he works out the argument, shows you how he comes to that conclusion. And then when he gets to chapter 12 and verse 8, he repeats it. "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity," says the preacher. Now it's obvious of great importance to us in understanding what he found out, to know what this word vanity means. What does the Hebrew word mean, not the English? The English word means something which is empty. But is that what Solomon found out about life? Well, I think not. This word vanity seems to have the idea about it of a vapour, thin air, if you like. It's not exactly nothing, but it's next to nothing. Vapour. This word vanity is used in Psalm 62 and verse 9. And Moffat's translation here is very much to the point. Psalm 62. He says, "Surely men of low degree are vanity, and men of high degree are a lie. To be laid in the balance, they are altogether lighter than vanity." But you can see that there's a comparison being made here. Lighter than what? Moffat has, "lighter and slighter than a breath of air." That's the idea behind this word vanity. A vapour, a breath of air. And this is the idea I feel that Eve had in her mind when she named her second son. For the Hebrew word as a proper noun, the word Abel or Hebel, is this word vanity. What high hopes Eve had when that first son was born. And she called his name Cain. "I have gotten a man," an acquisition. "I have gotten a man," and it says literally, "I have gotten a man, Jehovah." Perhaps she thought that this was the promised Messiah that had come, her firstborn son. But her hopes apparently were dashed. And when Abel was born afterwards, she gave him a name more in fitting with the character of man and his life. She called him Abel because she recognized that man's life was but a vapor, a vain thing. So Eve then knew of these things. James, in his epistle, talks about life being in a vapour. In James chapter 4, James 4, and we can see in what connection this vapour is brought in to his idea of life. James 4, verse 13. "Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain." What profit, says Ecclesiastes? Well, these men were seeking profit, but the Ecclesiastes says, what profit? What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? So James goes on from this position of gain. He says, whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapour that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. The key thought here seems to be that life is transitory. It's passing. It doesn't last. It passes. And so therefore it's called a vapour. And he says this in the context of riches. Look at chapter 5. Go to now, ye rich man. Weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted. Your garments are moth-eaten. Didn't the Lord remind the disciples that they were to lay up treasures for themselves where moth and dust would not corrupt? So here it is here. Here's a picture of this life. And so we can understand why Solomon asks, what profit to labour under the sun? The key thought here, surely, is of life which is passing, that which is transitory. And the one thing which writes vanity right across the labour of this life is, of course, death. And that is exactly the point to which Ecclesiastes comes. If you turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 12, as he begins to come to his conclusion, Ecclesiastes 12. He says in verse 1 that they are to remember their Creator in the days of their youth. And then in the very next verse is a very picturesque idea of death approaching, of old age, and then eventually death. Verse 7. Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. All is vanity. Death writes vanity across the whole of this vaporous life, as it were. Now the Apostle Paul, of course, you would expect, has got something to say about this. So we'll see what he says of this life. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Verse 17. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment. Well, he doesn't actually say vapour, does he? But it's a light affliction which is concerned with this life. For a moment, a vapour. Worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we look, not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Now this word temporal is the interesting word here. It's the word pros kairos. It means literally for a season. The things which are seen are for a season. And if you go back to Ecclesiastes, you'll see that this is exactly the thought that is in his mind. That this life is conditioned by seasons. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. From verses 1 onwards, he says, to everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up, and so on. A time and a season to everything. And man is conditioned by this. This is a picture of his life, a life conditioned by seasons. And in verse 11, he says he has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has set the world, or perhaps better, he has set the age in their heart. Now man himself has been limited then by something that's set in his heart. It's not easy to interpret this verse, but it looks as though what he's telling us is that man is conditioned by the season in which he finds himself. And this has been done for a particular reason. He has set the age in their heart so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Man finds himself occupied all the time in this vaporous life with those things which belong simply to times and to seasons. And in verse 10, the verse which immediately precedes this one we've just looked at, he says, I have seen the travail which God has given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. Now, why did he do this? To be exercised, we might almost translate it, to be occupied with. Man is kept occupied in these things, and it's looked upon as a travail which God has given to him to keep him occupied. Well, we can understand perhaps why this is, to keep him out of mischief. That's the point, surely, of the labour that was given to Adam. From the moment he sinned, he found his hands occupied. And I believe that it was probably to keep him out of mischief, at least one of the reasons. There's an old adage that the devil finds work for idle hands. And so keep man busy. Ecclesiastes is beginning to see where this seasonal life is leading him. I rather like also that other passage. If you turn to Exodus chapter 20, in the giving of the commandments, I don't think enough is made of this. Exodus 20. The fourth commandment, verse 9, 6 days shalt thou labour and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work. Now verse 9 is just as much imperative as verse 10. 6 days shalt thou labour and do all thy work, not 5 days, not 4 days. 6 days, just as much imperative. I think God knew what he was doing when he gave these commandments. We sometimes think that the imperative came with respect to the seventh day, but 6 days is just as much imperative here. And so it looks as though this is implied in the commandments. But also, if you come back to Ecclesiastes chapter 3, you'll see that man was not simply given these things to occupy him in order to weary him. There's something more to it than this. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 14. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be for the age. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it, why? That men should fear before him. Now we're beginning to come to the conclusion that Solomon's going to come to right at the end of this. That the whole duty of man is to fear God and to keep his commandments. Here it is that men should fear before him. So man is conditioned by time and season. There's a sore travail that is given to him. He's occupied with these things. And it's done that men might fear before him. Of course, the great tragedy of civilization is that it has taken men's minds off the curse which has been put on the earth. If a man goes out and labours in the sweat of his brow to bring forth a living from the ground, he remembers that there's a curse on the earth, and he remembers why that curse was put there. But give him civilization, give him labour-saving devices, and he'll forget that, and he'll forget to fear before him. But that's why God gave it, apparently, in the first place. And this is the conclusion that Ecclesiastes comes to. Fear God and keep his commandments. But there's something else that Ecclesiastes brings out here. Because although we are conditioned by present seasons, Solomon recognizes that there's another season which is to come. Look at verse 17. I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. For there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. So there's another season coming. It's a season of judgment. And although Ecclesiastes perhaps may not point very much to resurrection, at least we must see that this points on to a time when God is going to judge. Now let's look then at this future season and see how far Ecclesiastes can take us with respect to it. Solomon evidently wrote this book with an eye on the future. Perhaps he never had that tremendous hope in resurrection that those in Hebrews 11 had. But he did know that there was a judgment that was coming. So chapter 8 then of Ecclesiastes. And verse 11. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Because judgment doesn't take place straight away, man is inclined to go on in his evil ways. We know, of course, that there's going to come a time, and I think the millennium will be this time, when every man will die for his own iniquity, when judgment is visited day by day. But here, in the experience of Solomon, it's not so yet. That has not come to pass. So because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. But then a confidence. Though a sinner do evil 100 times, and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. So Ecclesiastes can't quite take us, can he, to this wonderful hope in resurrection. But he can take us and show that there's coming a judgment season, and that life in this world should be lived out in the light of it. And so if you turn to his conclusion in chapter 12 and verse 14. As I said, the Jews always used to read verses 13 and 14 round the other way, because they like to finish on a good note. So they would read verse 13 last. But strictly speaking, verse 14 is the last verse. God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. So here it is. We must be honest with Ecclesiastes. He doesn't give us a clear picture of resurrection, but he does lead us to see that there's going to be a judgment, and he implies that it's in a future season. And that surely leads us to an understanding of resurrection in some respect. Now, when I was considering the life of Solomon in order to understand this book better, the one thing that struck me was that Solomon's name does not appear in Hebrews chapter 11. And this may account for the fact that there's no glowing hope of resurrection in his life. Will you turn to Hebrews 11 for a moment and see how natural it would have been to have inserted his name? Hebrews 11. Verse 32. There has been one or two enumerated, and how they live by faith. And now the writer says, and what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, and of Barak, and of Samson, and of Jephthah, of David, of Solomon. No. How easy it would have been to have slipped Solomon's name in there. He was the one to follow David. But no, it's Samuel, and of all the prophets. Now, of course, I'm no judge of Solomon, and I mustn't put myself in the position of being so. But from Scripture, it looks as though Solomon is not included in the gallery of faith. And this may account for the fact of his writing Ecclesiastes and seeing so far and no further. He didn't see, apparently, this better hope. All he could see was that there was coming a judgment when things would be sorted out. Again, we know from Old Testament Scripture that David is going to be resurrected, and it is going to reign over the people of Israel. Well, I feel sure that Solomon's going to be resurrected. But he's not going to follow David. For the one which will follow David will be the greater than Solomon. He's the one that's going to take over the reins of government. And yet, when you've said all this, you've got to recognize that when Solomon was born, he was given that special name that meant that he was the beloved of God. And in this book, he's going to talk about a good name being better than precious ointment. A good name which apparently he had not got for himself, but which was given to him at the beginning, and he had spoilt. So back in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 then, this seems to be implied in this vanity, and it looks as though Solomon tasted it to some extent. Verse 3. What profit had a man of all his labour which he taketh under the sun. Now the word prophet means a remainder, something which is over and above. The idea of it can be felt from chapter 5. Verse 15, talking about a man who's going to die. As he came forth of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labour, which he may carry away in his hand. He can take nothing with him. And this also is a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath laboured for the wind? A pursuit of the wind. What profit? What is that over and above? And yet, coming back to chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes, although there doesn't appear to be any profit in this labour, yet Solomon recognises that everything is full of progression, everything is full of movement, everything seems to be going somewhere, and yet not getting anywhere. Look at verses 4 to 7 of Ecclesiastes 1. One generation passeth away, another generation cometh. The earth abideth forever. The earth is looked upon as being still with respect to these things. The sun also ariseth. The sun goeth down. And it hasteth to the place where he arose. A constant cycle, a constant movement, a constant progression. And yet, what profit? Verse 6, the wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. Even the rivers, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. A constant cycle of condensation and precipitation. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labour, all things are full of weariness. That's the thought here. And he says this because he can see that there's this constant movement and progression going on all the time, a constant cycle. And yet he can't see where it's all going. There doesn't seem to be any point in it. And when he turns to examine his own labours, he comes to the same conclusion. What profit has a man of all his labour, which he taketh unto the sun? Then in verses 9 to 11 of Ecclesiastes 1, he goes to show that nothing new comes of this. It's all the same old thing repeated. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us. It may be that man forgets. There is no remembrance of former things. Neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. But basically, there is nothing new. If a man thinks something's new, it's because he's forgotten. There is no remembrance of former things. So nothing new under the sun. But this word new is a word which is later going to be used by Jeremiah when he talks about the new covenant. And by Ezekiel when he talks about something which is essential for this people, the new heart that is going to be given to them. And Isaiah, when he looks beyond this present earth which is going to pass away, and he sees the new heavens and the new earth. So here it is, it belongs then to a future age. Verses 14 and 15 of Ecclesiastes 1. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Vexation of spirit is difficult to translate, but it seems to mean the pursuit of the wind. In other words, just fruitless labour. It's leading nowhere. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. And that which is wanting cannot be numbered. The defects cannot be made up. So what is he saying now? He's saying that man can do nothing to alter the present arrangement. Here's something that God has set in motion. Man can do nothing about it. He can just watch it going on. The crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. Look at chapter 7 and verse 13. This makes it clearer that this is the work of God that has brought this about. Consider the work of God, for who can make that straight which he has made crooked? Man can't do anything about this labour of the present time. Can't do anything about it. It's the work of God to do it. It's not the same word actually that's used here, but we can rejoice that it says this, that he's the one that is one day going to make the crooked straight and the rough places plain. It's in the hands of him. And so man is all the time here being conditioned by the times and the seasons in which he finds himself. He can do nothing to change this series of events. All things looked at from this point of view are full of weariness, a cycle in which there is nothing new. So here is Ecclesiastes, and you can see he's in the very depths of despair in considering these things. Now let's look then at the quest of Solomon in this book and see how he comes to this conclusion. Chapter 1 and verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out thy wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith, or to be occupied with. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. So Solomon is now going to tell us of his observations, of his experiences, and he says in verse 16 that none were in a better position to do this than him. I commune with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. Later on he's going to say, what more can the man do that comes after the king? Nobody can do more than Solomon has done here. Solomon has tested it out to the full. He had great riches, he had great wisdom. Both those gifts enabled him to test out the experiences and observations of life. And let's, before we pronounce Solomon as just groping about in the dark here, let's remember what the Lord allowed him to write at the end of this, that he sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. So the conclusions he's coming to here are correct conclusions. As I say, we must keep this under that expression that comes so many times in this book, the things which are done under the sun. We mustn't look away and read into this the glorious future in resurrection. We've seen that Solomon hardly had a hope in it. He just saw a judgment. He wasn't a Hebrews 11 man as far as we understand it. So Solomon then sets about this task of finding out concerning all things that are done under heaven or under the sun. And he begins naturally enough by considering wisdom. For this is the great gift that has been given to him, a gift of wisdom. In verse 17, I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. What he means really, I feel here, is that he put the two things in the balances. He put wisdom over here, and he put folly, the opposite of wisdom, over there, and he compared the two things. And he tried to see if there was any advantage in having wisdom, rather than being a foolish person. And he comes to the conclusion, I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit, it's fruitless labour to have this wisdom. Why? Because in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow. The more wisdom a man gains, the more the folly that is around him comes into perspective, and he sees just how foolish things are. And the more he knows of what's going on in this world, well, the sorrier he becomes, because he sees just how, what a sorry plight things are in. So wisdom then, and knowledge and the pursuit of them, in effect, is a seeking after wind, a fruitless labour. Now, Solomon often in this book returns to this subject of wisdom. I feel he has it on his mind here. In chapter 2 and verse 12, he looks at it again. I turn myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do that cometh after the king? None were wiser than him. Even that which he hath done, which he hath been already done, so he cannot do any more. Then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly as far as light excelleth darkness. We mustn't say there's no advantage in wisdom. It may bring grief and sorrow, but as he's later on going to tell us, sorrow is better for the heart than laughter. Sorrow makes the heart, is good for the heart. So, this is important here then. Wisdom excels folly as far as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head. The fool walketh in darkness. But then a terrible thing is written across this. I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all. You see, the wise man may have an advantage in being wise, but when all is said and done, across it is going to be written the word death. One event to the wise and to the foolish. In verse 15, then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. And why was I then more wise? He begins now to query, why has been given this wisdom? Then I said in my heart that this also is vanity. Chapter 9 of Ecclesiastes is back on the same subject of wisdom. And he tells a little story. Verse 13. This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemeth great unto me. There was a little city, and few men within it. And there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built great bulwarks against it. Now there was found in it a poor, wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. And yet here's the tragedy of it all. Yet no man remembered the same poor man. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Obviously it was in this case. No good this little city trying to come up against his great king with all his bulwarks, with all his armies. Wisdom was what was needed, and this man had it. Wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. This is the folly, in a sense, of having wisdom that a man is not listened to for being wise. And the folly in Solomon's life was this, that here he was given this wisdom and then he went and made a complete mess of the whole thing by marrying all these women from other countries. And they turned his heart away from the Lord. In one sense, we can say that Solomon was the wisest man that ever lived. And yet you can say, on the other hand, that he was also the most foolish. So here it is, wisdom has got to be applied. And the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. Well, Solomon never apparently listened to his own wisdom. Verse 18, wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. Oh, look, verse 17, first of all, we've missed this. The words of wise men are heard in quiet, and they are better than, this is rather gives the wrong impression here, they are better than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Isn't it the common lot of mankind to listen to the man with the loudest voice? If you doubt this, go to a union meeting, and you'll have it confirmed. They never listen to that wise man that knows the implications of these things. Because the words of the wise men are heard in quiet. That's the point. They're not shouted, as it were, from the housetops. And so these men are very often not listened to. Verse 18, wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. Isn't that true here? Then he goes on in chapter 10 and verse 1 to give us a proverb. And I rather feel he's got himself in mind here. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savour. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honour. Now that is Solomon, isn't it? All over. A man in reputation for wisdom and honour, and yet that folly which came into his life, those great mistakes that he made in allowing his heart to be turned away to worship other idols. Well, there's the test of wisdom then in this book. Now back in chapter 2, Ecclesiastes, Solomon tries something else out. Verses 1 to 3, I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure. And behold, he didn't take very long to find out that pleasure doesn't lead anywhere. Behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, madness. And of mirth, what doeth it? What is the profit of it? What profit in laughter? I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, but carefully I didn't get myself drunk. Yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, I wanted as it were to stand outside myself and see what profit there was in drinking wine, what good it did. So I was wise about this. And to lay hold on folly till I might see, and here's his great search, what was that good for the sons of men which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. What should a man do in the light of these things? What is the good thing that he should occupy himself with? Well, he tells us, of course, in his conclusion, that it is to fear God and to keep his commandments. And that has never changed. It may be expressed, as I say, in different terms in our calling, but it has never basically changed. I'll just read you the words of Micah 6. In verse 7, this is what the prophet says. Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Well, this is exactly what Solomon said. He said that obedience, in effect, is better than a sacrifice of fools. Will the Lord be pleased with such sacrifice? Verse 8. He has showed thee, O man, what is good. He showed you what is good. Now he's going to tell us what it is. What does the Lord require of thee? But to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. So here's Micah's conclusion, and here's the conclusion also that Solomon is going to come to. Ecclesiastes 2. Now he prosecutes another test. He recognizes that in the world that the lot of man is work and toil. Very well, he says, I'll try it out. I'll see what satisfaction comes from this work and toil. Verse 4. I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens. Verse 6, I made me pools of water. The things he made, he was occupied. And yet that never brought satisfaction. He went further. He began to gain things, to acquire things. Verses 7 and 8. I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle, above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me silver and gold, the peculiar treasure of kings. I gat me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments, and that of all sorts. So I was great, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained in me. And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. He tried everything to do with pleasure and work and anything you can think of. For my heart rejoiced in all my labour, but this was the tragedy. This was my portion of all my labour. Just the pleasure of the moment. That was the portion, the rejoicing of the moment, the rejoicing in the actual doing of the work, and nothing was over and remained. Verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labour that I had laboured to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no remainder, no profit under the sun. So here's his conclusion then, that he comes to. In verse 18 he goes on from this position, and he considers another evil. He says, I hated all my labour. All this work that he's put in, he's now beginning to hate it. which I had taken under the sun. Why? Because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? And I think he had in mind his son here, Rehoboam, who turned out to be a fool indeed and followed in his father's footsteps. So he considered this work then, and he said that it was all vanity and vexation of spirit. Now how then is one to live in the light of all this, says Solomon. Verse 24, there is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labour. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. And in our last study we looked at a number of passages which all come to this same conclusion. In the light of these things, the one thing that really matters is this, in one word, contentment. That's the point. Contentment. Recognition of the present limitations, the present seasonal nature of things. Contentment written right across it. We're limited by season. There's only one thing that I know in Scripture that's not limited by seasons, and that's the preaching of the word. Be instant, in season, out of season. Preach the word. But here we are, limited by these seasons. And this contentment is to be exercised in the light of future judgment. It may be that Solomon was not one of these Hebrews 11 men, but all those in Hebrews 11, the great thing about them was that they were content. Abraham came into a land that was given to him. He never sought to gain for himself wealth. He never built great cities. He was content to live in tents with Jacob and Isaac. Contentment. Why was this? Because he had an eye to the future. And you remember that even Solomon himself, in that psalm which is attributed to him, said this, except the Lord build the house, they that labour, labour in vain. And so Solomon knew this, although he may not have applied it to his own life. But of course the great key of Hebrews 11 is the word resurrection. And Solomon could only partly see this, could only see it as a judgment. And it's written of all those there in Hebrews 11 that they all died, not having received the promise. They never got it in this life, but they looked for it by faith. So Solomon's conclusion is this then, that death writes vanity right across the labour of this life. No profit. And you know, we might say also that this applies with respect to certain ideas about Christ. What did Paul say? He said, if in this life only we hope in Christ, hope in Christ in this life, if only that, we are of all men most miserable. But you know, almost in the same context, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, in the great resurrection chapter, he assures us that because of resurrection, and only because of resurrection, our labour is not in vain in the Lord. And so what Ecclesiastes, what Solomon could only partly see, Paul brings to a head, as it were, in the New Testament, and gives us the hope, the only hope that mankind can have. It's vested not in the things of this life, but in resurrection. Now when we meet together the next time, we will consider more of the message of this book, a melancholy book, but which is intended to lead us, I'm sure, to a realisation of the vanity of this present life and lead us on to an understanding of the wonder of that which comes through resurrection.